We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer of the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. In 2009, it was reported that the Pentagon and various intelligence agencies were beginning to take climate change seriously, saying climate change will present profound strategic challenges that could demand humanitarian relief or military response. This morning, we'll talk about climate change and its potential impact on people, the environment, and geopolitics. Don Wubbles of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences and Jesse Rebo of the Department of Geography and the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois are our guests. Listeners, you may join the discussion with a telephone call or an email message. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Don Wubbles is the Harry Preble Endowed Professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, as well as in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the U of I. He was a lead author on the first and second international assessments of climate change, sponsored by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Jesse Rebo is an associate professor of geography and affiliate of the Beckman Institute, where he leads an initiative on social dimensions of environmental policy. His fellowships have included a MacArthur Fellowship at Harvard. He has conducted numerous studies for the World Bank and the UN. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Professors Wubbles and Rebo, welcome. So good to have you here in the studio this morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
As I mentioned in my introduction, what I hope we'll do this morning is to cover some basic questions and look at potential impacts of climate change. And here to start, maybe I would ask the two of you this question. How telling is it, how significant is it that the Pentagon is saying now climate change will present profound challenges?
Well, first of all, we know from the scientific analysis that there is just no question about the importance of this issue. Climate change is something that's going to confront us, our children, our grandchildren, throughout the century and beyond, because of the impacts that we're having on our environment because of human activities. Specifically, the increase in carbon dioxide, increases in other what are called radiatively important gases or greenhouse gases, and also the particles we put in the atmosphere are all having an impact on our climate, and we expect to have major changes over the century. It's important in that, as part of that recognition, the public often hears about global warming, and that almost sounds fuzzy and nice, and you know, why should we be concerned? But in fact, the science community always refers to it as climate change, which is kind of a boring way of talking about it, but in fact, it's because it isn't just as simple as warming. You know, most of the planet will warm, not all of it, but more importantly, we're going to see a significant increase, and already seeing a significant increase, in the amount of large precipitation events, large heat waves, the kind of significant impacts we've already seen this year with major flooding in Pakistan, with a huge heat wave hitting Russia, much like the huge heat wave that hit Europe in 2003. Those are highly unusual events, but what we're expecting is that the probability of such events is increasing and is going to continue to increase. And it's those that we have particular concerns about in terms of how our climate is changing.
Yeah, I totally agree with Don. The question, though, about the Pentagon's concern, I don't really have a lot of insight into the Pentagon's reaction to this, but I'm always worried when I see the Pentagon stepping in.
It says a lot, I think, doesn't it?
It does, and it says that there's a reframing of environmental change as a strategic defense, a national security issue, which I'm sure there are aspects of national security that will be affected by climate change. But it seems to me that most critically it's a question of security in the sense of local well-being and the reduction of people's vulnerability mm-hmm. in particular places. Yet there's certainly a rising discussion and discourse on trans-border migration, on disasters and their political and economic and social effects.
When I think of Pakistan this summer, what immediately comes to my mind is the immense misery and human suffering, the toll that is taken on human beings. When it comes to climate change and all the many myriad possibilities and impacts, who has a voice in what our approach should be, how we should prepare? Is there, we think of governments, we think of militaries, we think of the UN, but what about at the local level?
Yeah.
What about at the village level? What about at a state level, a city level?
Yeah. Voice travels through many pathways. And I think first thing I would say is that events like what we saw in Pakistan may be unusual and extreme, but they're not new. There have been floods and droughts worldwide throughout history. There have been earthquakes. There have been storms. And the way in which governments react, respond, prepare is in some way a function of voice. Amartya Sen did a famous study comparing India and China and basically made the statement that in China we see very little hunger in the face of varying economic, social, political, and climate sorts of events. But we see famine. In India, since the 1943 Bangladesh famine, we see very little famine because it's politically untenable in a democratic circumstance. But we see widespread, persistent hunger because hunger doesn't excite the media as much as bodies that are dropping to the ground. And so voice that comes through media has an effect in that it can be politically fatal to see famine in your country. But hunger and widespread suffering doesn't seem to do the job. And in China, voice travels through administrative channels and through with different motives behind it. But it's not that there is no voice. There is some responsiveness. It may not be linked to voice. It may be linked to perceived responsibilities of government. At the most local level, however, there's a very there's a lot of discussion in the last two decades of decentralized representation and the role of decentralization in environmental management. Does this improve people's well-being? Does it improve their ability to invest in their own livelihoods? And the answer appears to be yes on a theoretical level, but on an empirical level, we see very little real decentralization taking place, so it's hard to answer what its effects would be.
I'd like to just add a little bit to what Jesse said. I think the difference here, as we're concerned about climate over the coming decades, is it's not that we won't be seeing disasters that we've had before, or large events, but that the probability of such events is changing.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, if we look at the state of Iowa, they just had their third 100-year flood in the last 17 years. Well, maybe that's telling us that all those policies that were developed for levees, et cetera, that were based on a 100-year flood aren't working anymore because the probability of what was a 100-year flood is changing. It's no longer a 100-year mm-hmm. flood. So we need to be looking at policies to adapt that are going to take into account the kind of changes we're going to expect to happen with the climate, and climate being the long-term changes in weather, so that now we can do adaptation or evaluation of our vulnerabilities to be able to do better policies. And there's lots of discussion of that going on, both within the U.S. government and at state governments and cities. You know, cities like Chicago are already putting in policies for adaptation that are very far-reaching as to help the city prepare for the changes likely to happen over the century.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I suppose part of that is as a result of that devastating heat wave of several years ago that killed hundreds of people in Chicago.
Sure.
When you talk about, Jesse, when you talk about decentralization, so then are we talking about what we need is leadership from the top? Is that what you're talking about?
Decentralization is basically the transfer of powers from central government down to
okay.
lower levels within the political administrative hierarchy of the state, so that we're talking about local governments like the city
Chicago.
Of Chicago, like Urbana-Champaign municipal governments, like customary municipalities in various places, local government in Africa, municipios in Latin America, which are taking more and more which are being given more and more legal responsibility but often not the power to manage those resources, so the outcomes are somewhat ambiguous.
What are the objectives of the social dimensions of environmental policy initiative?
They are essentially to get people who are looking at issues around environmental change to understand the multiple causes of risk and vulnerability that people experience. And a good example of this would be, I'm not familiar with the three recent 100-year floods, but in Bangladesh there were cyclones in 1970, 1991, and 2007. And many of the analysts back in the 1970s, well, really in the 80s, late 80s to 90s, of climate and its consequences talked about impacts of climate change. And they would see a storm that would kill 500,000 people in Bangladesh, like in 1970, as a climate event. Climate killed 500,000 people. But if you begin looking in 1991, the same magnitude cyclone killed 140,000 people. And then it was 2007, the same magnitude cyclone, actually a larger magnitude cyclone in the same area of Bangladesh, killed only 3,400 people, a 150-fold decrease in fatality for the same magnitude climate event. Therefore, you cannot call this the impact, any of these, the impacts of climate. These are climate-related problems that have to do with social, political, economic preparedness, well-being, all kinds of underlying social conditions. And so the negative outcomes associated with climate events, we want to begin to bring in the entire analytic myriad of causal structures so that when we think about climate as a problem, we understand that it is one stressor and causal factor amongst many. Granted, a disastrous one mm-hmm. in itself, an extremely important one, but usually the reason that people experience hunger, famine, dislocation, or economic loss has almost nothing to do with a climate event. The same magnitude drought in northeast Brazil killed 3 million people in the first half of the last century. same magnitude drought in southwest United States would kill nobody. And so we have to go from this idea of impacts of climate change to causes of vulnerability. That is, the multiple causes of a single outcome, the outcome being hunger, famine, dislocation, economic loss, often triggered by one of those factors, which is climate variability, climate change. But the mitigating factors or other factors, as in the ability of people to build assets, the quality of infrastructure, the emergency planning, those things are what we call the social dimensions of environmental change.
Okay. And Don Wibbles, for you, I would ask, what is the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and are you dealing with some of the same things that Jesse talked about?
I'm going to be a coordinating lead author on the next major IPCC assessment, the international assessment. There's actually three volumes to that assessment, and I'm on the science report where we're looking purely at the scientific understanding of climate and, you know, what do we expect for the future. But one of the other reports actually fully deals with this question of vulnerability and what kind of things are likely to happen as a result in the world. So not only looking at mitigation of the effects of human activities on climate, but also looking at this question of vulnerability and being able to adapt to that vulnerability in ways that we can get various peoples of the world to respond and to consider new policies on how they're dealing with these issues.
You're agreeing?
I totally agree.
This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this morning we're talking about climate change and its potential impacts on people and the environment. Our guests this morning are Don Wibbles of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences and Jesse Rebo of the Department of Geography and the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, the phone number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to back up and talk a little bit about the science of climate change. Is it clear that there is a link between human activities and climate change? And if so, to what extent are we responsible for climate change?
You know, one thing to be aware of is that, you know, the climate always changes naturally due to their variations in the Earth's climate system that causes changes. It's also there are also forcings, external forcings like the changes that are occurring in the sun, but none of those types of changes can explain, or those kind of forcings can explain the changes we're seeing. We know very clearly that the large extent of the changes we've seen over the last 50 years, and we've seen very significant changes worldwide, can only be explained because of the increase in carbon dioxide and these other human-related emissions that's causing an increase in natural. You know, there are very significant natural levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Of course, we wouldn't be here without it. What's called the greenhouse effect actually keeps the Earth temperature to the point where we can have life as we know it. But the problem is that we're increasing that forcing on the climate system. It's like adding an extra blanket to the Earth, in a sense. And the Earth of all is going to be warming, but it's also going to be seeing all these other kind of changes we've been talking about as well. So the science is actually very clear. You know, sometimes I think the media gives a suggestion that this is highly controversial, that there's lots of denial going on within the scientific community about whether this is real or not. In reality, if we look at the science, the actual science understanding, and look at the peer-reviewed papers, and look at the major meetings of scientists, there's just no question about the importance of this issue. There is no real controversy there at all. Unfortunately, there's a few blogs and a few people that are out there putting out misinformation that try to make it give this idea to the public that this is highly controversial, but to the science community, it really isn't.
If this is serious, climate change, why have we been slow to respond? Why has this not caught our attention and our imagination, quite frankly?
I think it has caught our imagination. I think one of the interesting issues that we have to ask ourselves is we know that people suffer in the face of drought, floods, storms in the past. And we still often have not responded in the past. And will projecting into the future these mega crises or more frequent, more intense kinds of extreme weather events, will that cause political actors to respond? Now, in Bangladesh, you see a real success story where a 150-fold decrease in the fatality of storms was achieved through planning. In many other places, we see populations are not attended to, especially in dry lands where people are exposed to drought conditions and where their lower productivity causes governments to invest in more productive, more humid areas where they're going to get a better return on their funding, on their finances, and often ignore areas where the real need is one of human security, of food security.
This is Focus. We're talking this morning about climate change. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us on the phone. Let's go first to a listener calling in on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. Got a simple question that I don't know anything about. In the scientific community, you said that you made the statement that the science is clear and there's no doubt about it. So in the scientific community, if you had 1,000 scientists and maybe 5 disagreed, would that mean that it would be unequivocal that that is accurate, that the scientific community has established something? Or what percent of people or scientists does it tip in the other direction? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's an interesting question. When I say there's no question about the science, that does say the very vast majority of the scientists agree. Are there a few people that will disagree? And is the disagreement, you're going to find that scientists are humans too. Of course, they have their own political outlooks. They have their own economic outlooks. You're going to find that there are a few people that disagree. But does what the science they are publishing really demonstrate a strong basis for disagreement is the question. And that's what's not there. There is nothing being published that is denying that this issue isn't very real. So people will often talk about that these people that are questioning things that they should have just as much validity as the rest of the science community, and I don't think any of us in science would disagree with that in terms of, if you look seriously at the quality of the science. We're, by our very nature, scientists are always questioning the validity of our understanding. That's what being a scientist is all about. It's the search for truth. And so if And so we're always, questioning that. And so if there was a new understanding that gave us a real basis for thinking that this issue was not real, that there was some new scientific understanding that made a difference there, I think we'd be quick to grab onto that. We would not have such a clear majority. Now, so if you took 1,000 scientists, could you find that there were a few that were that would say no, that they're not sure this is real? Definitely. There's just no question that there are a few. But is what they're publishing telling us that there is a basis for their disagreement? The answer is no. There's nothing out there that disagrees.
I would just add that I think that there is a lot that is very well established. We know CO2 levels are changing. We know these things. There's also a lot of uncertainty in how we predict the exact climate effects of that. But the uncertainty is within a certain range where, by and large, it points to increasing temperatures and increasing frequency of storms, and the data coming in shows that we're observing that as well. We're beginning to observe that. We can't make the direct, absolutely solid causal links, but we can, in a general way, make that association. I think that it's fairly solid.
And in some cases, we actually can make causal links. There's some things you cannot explain at all that are being observed without human activities being the basis and the increase in carbon dioxide. So there's some things we really have very, very solid information on.
Yeah.
And there are other things that, yes, we're uncertain about. And a lot of that is the projections for the future.
Exactly.
Half of the problem there is projecting how much are we going to continue to use fossil fuels in the same way as we are now over the coming decades. That's probably our single largest uncertainty. And so when we do national assessments of climate change or we do international assessments, we try to take all of those uncertainties into the analyses. So when we present things to the federal government or to the world governments, we are basically trying to present that whole picture to them
exactly.
of what those possibilities
are. Yeah, and let me add that uncertainty does not mean you stop planning. We have an uncertainty about when and how intense storms that will hit different places will be. Doesn't mean we don't know that they're coming and that we should plan for them.
Well, we all take out insurance on our
exactly.
houses and our cars because, we don't think we're going to have those problems, but, we're not sure.
Those who are wealthy enough take out insurance.
Jesse Rebo, how complex is mapping and planning for and addressing causes of vulnerability?
It's very complex. I think it depends on which vulnerabilities you're talking about. You have to be very specific. Vulnerability is not to climate. Nobody is vulnerable to climate. Nobody is vulnerable to what we call the hazards. You're vulnerable to negative outcomes. Vulnerability is the exposure to damage, the likelihood of damage. And so we talk about vulnerability as being vulnerable to hunger, famine, dislocation, economic loss, things of that sort. And each of those, I think, has to be some of them are more linked together than others, but for example, you have to look at them differently in that economic loss is going to have very different effects. There are some people who have no wealth to lose, so we're not going to find economic loss amongst the poorest. But of course, when they lose assets, which are economic assets of sorts, they are driven into much deeper crisis than someone who may lose enormous amounts of infrastructure and wealth in another area, but will come out with no moment in which they experience hunger or famine. But explaining then the cause of a given negative outcome, take Katrina, take the flooding of the Lower Ninth Ward. I've not studied this problem, but over time it went from a discourse on a large storm that caused flooding, negligence in maintaining a dam, to even a legal indictment of the Army Corps of Engineers by I don't recall which one of the circuit courts it was in Louisiana, in which they established causality to failures of the Army Corps of Engineers. And so when you talk about the causes of damages related to an event, a hurricane, locating it in the sky is going to be very different.
Mm.
In fact, I would say you can never really locate the causes in the sky. You have to look at the underlying social conditions, since no matter how intense the event, there will be some people in the same area who will experience very little loss, others who will experience great loss as a function of gender, ethnicity, class. And so those things become the causal factors of the damage, whereas the trigger or the stress is what we see as being the thing to which people are exposed and which, in a linear causal sense, will lead to negative outcomes in that snapshot moment when it occurs.
One of the interesting things is if you look at the analysis of the climate projections, the largest changes are expected at high latitudes and the smallest changes in the tropics. However, because of the poverty existing worldwide throughout the tropics, it's actually those people that are likely to be most vulnerable, even to some relatively small changes compared with what others are going to be seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah, just on that, too, because I gave a U.S.-based example, in the tropics, there are many famine early warning systems in place. And those famine early warning systems look for indicators of the probability that someone will go hungry or die. And oftentimes, the measures and indicators used are very proximate. They will look at thinning of bodies, literally, the height-to-weight ratio of children. They'll look at storage of crops, whether there's a buffer in the bins anymore, in order to say, okay, now it's time to mobilize a prevention strategy. Yet when you ask, why are these bins so poorly stocked, you begin to look at the whole political, economic, and social context of why farmers cannot accumulate income and invest in their own well-being. They are taxed in kind, taxed in labor, corvée in many places, forced labor. They are in unequal exchange relations. They are exploited in terms of their labor and poor remuneration. All of those things become the causal factor behind the cause that is seen mostly by early responders and made into an indicator, which is low grain bins and thinning. But how did that get produced? That's a long-term historical, social, political, economic phenomenon that leads us to questions of policy and who produces them and why. Who's at the table.
Yeah, we've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. We're going to go next to Effingham, Line 4.
Yes, a couple of things. The event in Pakistan, which is the most recent, and information about the wealthy able to dam off their property and flood people downstream. And those people who do things like that represent a capitalist class, I think, which you have continued to talk about. And the other thing that I'm thinking, if we have, they, and do you folks admit that there is global warming due to human activity? And if so, an event like Krakatoa, and we never know when those seismic things are going to occur. Maybe we feel the rumble, but once it happens, it's too late, like you've said throughout this program. But the thing that I think gets to me the most is the fact that the poor die and the rich live.
Okay.
I think that's right on. And I think this question in Pakistan that you mentioned of the wealthy being able to build protections, levees, for example, I'm not sure of the situation. It's not unusual. It creates downstream problems. more water for others. But it's not always the rich dumping on the poor, as in the U.S., where we've often built in areas that we shouldn't have because there were public funds to divert waterways in ways that made the Mississippi more at risk of a disastrous outcome in a high flood than a low flood. So lower floods are well controlled, but that control of the lower level floods has created a more generalized exposure and risk for everybody.
Yeah, one of the things I also think we need to be clear on is that, you know, we can't claim that the event in Pakistan is due to climate change. That's a weather event.
Right.
We can't take any particular weather event and say that, well, that's related to climate change. You know, we really base climate off the long-term statistics and analysis that, you know, that can tell us something. So that particular event, we can't say anything. And a lot of the problems in Pakistan were indeed related to not only this being a, you know, really high-level weather event, but also because of the changes, and, you know, in many cases, the lack of preparations that were made for such events throughout the country.
Should we take another call? Let's go to Mendota, line one. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting topic. So many problems and not enough time, right? You know, I'm really amazed that the infrastructure in this country. We all know, like for instance, Katrina, with the levee system down south. I don't understand the way our government operates anymore. Most of my family lives in Holland, for instance, and I've brought the subject up before. Their levee system is excellent. They're probably the best one in the world, bar none. And yet, you know, we're the most developed country in the world, and yet we can't figure that out. We can't. I don't understand it. That's one thing. I didn't think it's a lot of greed, a lot of, you know, not misplanning. The other thing is I used to live in a town where it was close to where you guys are. It's like they connect the new to the old. Well, when you do that, they've got, you know, twice the size drains running into half the size drains. So every time it rains hard now, guess what? It floods. Well, bad planning and bad management of the infrastructure. Secondly, the other thing I want to comment on and real quick would be the climate change. This world has gone over climate, has had three different ice ages. It killed off the dinosaurs. Very many civilizations have come and gone. And so I don't think we've been studying the climate change as long as we should. I mean, we've only been doing this for like 100 years, so I think it's going to take 200 to 300 before we get it right. But I do realize that there is a problem with pollution. And, you know, every citizen in the country, and in fact in the world, has their obligation to make sure we don't, you know, pollute. But it's going to be, until we get off the oil-based products, it'll never change. And people don't want to give up their cars. People don't want to give up, you know, I try to ride a bike. But I'm just curious what your comments would be, and tell me if I'm hogwashed or not. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Okay. Thanks for the call. A lot of information there, a lot of issues on the table.
Let me respond to that last one first. You know, sometimes people will bring up the past changes in climate because of ice ages, et cetera, as a basis that we really don't know what's going on. Well, you know, we do study the past climates. In recent years, we've achieved a pretty good understanding of why the ice ages occur the way they do, and why some of the past climates have been as warm as they were. And so, and our knowledge there is not perfect, of course, but we do take into account the understanding of what's happened in the past in terms of looking at what's happening now and into the future. And as I said before, we cannot explain what we're seeing now without inducing the effects of human activities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very, very clear. And countries like Holland actually are making excellent preparations for that. You know, they're preparing for the sea level to increase by a meter or more, over a yard, in the next century. The U.S. so far is not doing anything. to prepare for that kind of sea level change.
Yeah.
It's going to be devastating to some parts of our country unless we start doing it. You know, major portions of Florida would be underwater in that case.
Yeah, I think that that I also would say it's hard to understand why we don't make the right investments. But I think there are some things that are somewhat easy to understand. We could be mitigating very easily. Energy conservation is an obvious arena in which reducing our emissions would save us money, even if there was no climate change. But we live in a country where there is an ideology of a market that says, oh, we can't limit who drives SUVs and we can't limit who drives certain kinds of Humvees, let's say, automobiles. Anyone can do whatever they want. Freedom, liberty, all these ideals. And so instead, we invest money in trying to find some new technology that will allow a Humvee to get 100 miles to the gallon or something. Of course, it's impossible. And so you end up with a Humvee that gets half a mile to the gallon better than it did before. And what really is at stake here is the question of to what degree do we accept regulation? And there is an ideology that government is bad that is prevalent in this country. Reagan, Thatcher, shrink it down. The less regulation, the better. And yet social welfare is dependent worldwide on systematic government policy that does limit certain things that people can do.
Let's take another call. This is a listener on line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Good morning. You've been clear on the degree of certainty about climate change within the scientific community, as well as about the importance of policy change to improving well-being. Following up on some of Professor Rebo's remarks about planning and the Army Corps of Engineers, I'm wondering which professionals are best prepared to actually address the emergent problems of climate change in technical terms, meaning which professionals either already have the skills or are currently developing new skills to address problems that hadn't been anticipated in the past. And I'll listen to your answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. That's a wonderful question. I would argue that we have the technical capacity for solving almost every problem that confronts us, and we have it on the shelf. It's not going to be a matter of necessarily fabulous new innovations. Most things can be dealt with. So we don't need to do front-edge research on vehicle design, which is a good thing to do, and we will make advances there. I think the potential to make advances with existing technology are so great that should be the first priority. Then the question becomes, well, why don't we do it? And this is something that in terms of social science research, we know very little. The questions of how problems are even identified and produced, what is a problem, is a matter of who it's a problem for. If it's not a problem for those who are in some way related to the political system that shapes policy, or who are marginalized, it becomes less of a priority. Even if we know what the problem is, the link between problems and solutions is not always clear. We have them on the shelf, perhaps, but policymakers may not want to make them into policy or a mandate of any sort, and that is because of the risks of action that they confront and their priorities. They may take an action that's short-term or long-term, may color whether they're going to use public funds for these things. And that action may not result in the outcomes that we expected. We don't really know. And even if it doesn't, will the people it affects voice their dissatisfaction in a way that a policymaker will even hear it? And even if they do, will the policymaker know how to aggregate those many voices into a response when they are embedded in a system which is highly influenced by particular interest groups who are well organized versus the more vulnerable populations who tend to have weaker voice, be less organized, and more marginal to the political system. So I think that this is really something that requires more study but is not going to be the domain of scientists alone. It will be social scientists and political activists as well who need to intervene together.
I would agree with Jesse that it's really has to do with our willpower and also our awareness. A lot of companies across the U.S. are starting to look at sustainability within their operations for various reasons, because they can make money, more money, by being more sustainable, but also because they need to be aware of these kind of issues. I led the development of a new certificate program that's online, and also a new actual undergraduate major that's going to be online, both in environmental sustainability. And in that program, we're trying to make sure that the people are well aware of climate issues and how that relates to their lives and to their companies, and how they can be applying the knowledge they gain into their own jobs. So
exactly.
And I think that's the kind of thing we need to have more of, and it's that awareness thing that I think is going to help us lead to the willpower.
But to expect that corporations will self-regulate, I think, is naive and wrong, and I think it's what is being done. Many environmental groups are inviting corporations onto their boards. This is problematic. They will, in fact, innovate when it's economically in their interest. But this is not the only time they'll innovate. They will innovate when they're told to by regulation. And part of the problem is that if an innovation is more costly than its immediate return, they lose competitivity unless there's a forced legislation that makes all corporations innovate simultaneously. I think we need to come back to a regulatory worldview that brings the state back in as a good actor, an actor that can, in fact, promote these improvements.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Very sophisticated conversation. I want to try to ask a simple question. I think a lot of this boils down to, what the common man perceives as our ability to impact the environment. And even as a trained ecosystems person, and I get out into the big, wide open spaces of the Western U.S., and things look so big. How can this be all our fault? What I would like to see, and perhaps you can point me to a URL or whatever, is something like the cubic miles of coal that have been consumed since 1850, or the cubic miles of petroleum that have been consumed, in the last 100 years. Something to really, kind of latch onto as a visceral kind of feel about what kind of impact we have. The plume goes up, it gets dissipated, and we don't think about it much. So are there real numbers like that out there I can find?
Certainly. The Department of Energy has a website that just gives all those kind of facts. I don't remember what it is, though, off the top of my head. But if you look at it's going to be DOE.gov.
Yeah, okay.
But I don't know exactly what it is. But, yeah, that's all available. And, it's often the case. I remember, having a discussion with the former governor of the state of Washington about climate. And she argued, how can us puny little humans have an impact on such a huge atmosphere we live in? But the reality is we see signs of that every day. At a more local level, we saw how the pollution affected London and affected other major cities. On the larger scale, things are happening. We have clear measurements of it and clear enough knowledge about it. It is hard to fathom sometimes just how much impact we're having, though.
But I think the common person, the common woman or man, might actually perceive these things not only in terms of the actual environment around them, but the people around them. And one of the things, the question, what can you do, is a very troubling question because, for example, there are things I could do. I could make my life voluntarily more simple. There are people who call for voluntary simplicity. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to reduce my consumption when the wealthy people next door are spewing into the atmosphere untold amounts of pollutants. I mean, I will, because it's actually – it feels better to me. But I think you won't get that on a widespread basis. You'll get some people who reduce their consumption in a way that makes the same product cheaper for the other people who want to increase their consumption to continue polluting. This, in other words, I think the experience of regulation in a sense becomes something – well, when there is regulation, people experience that others are being pushed into the same circumstance. They feel limits that they can't feel because they're not being imposed upon us by our own economic wealth, and they need to be imposed another way. So we don't feel them because we live in a highly affluent society.
Yeah, certainly. Wonderful points. And I'm an advocate of, you know, regulation, you know, the power plant camping that we did in the cap and trade system in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, turned around sulfate deposition in the eastern part of the United States to a tremendous extent. What I'm looking for is some way to make sense to, you know, my brother who's the steel worker. But, you know, Bob, I know you can't, you know, all this stuff about ecosystems, ecology, and atmospheric chemistry, that's pretty, you know, a little abstract. But, you know what a cubic mile looks like, so let's talk about it in those terms of reference.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's where you win the hearts and minds of the people to get to the regulatory structure and really cause a sea change in the way that we think about these. So wonderful conversation, gentlemen. I'll let you go. Have a wonderful weekend.
You might also want to look at the U.S. climate assessment at globalchange.gov, and you can, I think, /U.S. impacts or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's USGCRP website and U.S. Global Change Research Program website. And I think you can, if you start looking at that report, you can gain a lot more understanding of the kind of impacts we're talking about in the United States over this century.
And there we have to leave it because we are out of time. My thanks this morning to Don Wubbles and Jesse Rebo of the University of Illinois.
Thank you.